Well, thanks, Justin. Thank you all for coming. I can see people getting out to do things on a cold evening, but to come for 4 hours, I wonder, does Union University pay you guys to do this for 4 hours in the evening? Oh, you pay them. Oh, then they have really got a good racket going, then, don't they?
Not even money.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you for coming. Thank you to Justin for inviting me. I appreciate that. We'll be covering a lot of territory. I can assure you that the titles of my talks are much beyond what we'll be able to get covered. I sometimes think I'm better at writing titles than I am at writing talks. At the end of the evening, I'll let you vote on that. You'll be the judge of that. It's great to be here. And I want to start off by taking a few minutes to give you background on the Humanitas Project. Why is there a Humanitas Project? Humanitas is, some of you will know from having studied Latin, is the Latin root, the place where we get our word human or humanness. It's actually better translated humanness. So when we talk about bioethics, we're talking about the ethics of biology, the biological research, and the application of that research in the medical field. And so humanity really is the subject in bioethics. What does it mean to be human? That'll be a question that we address throughout the evening. What does it mean to be human? And we'll find that the change is currently a change, a revolution, in fact, in what it means to be human that's occurring, has already occurred in many ways in our culture. Let me give you a little background on the Humanitas Project. I spent most of my working career in industrial sales and marketing. When I got out of college, I taught school for a few years and realized that I needed some education in theology, church history. I was teaching Sunday school class, spending all day on Saturday getting ready for my Sunday school class on Sunday, and I thought, wow, I need some education. Had some friends that had gone to a Bible college. I started in Bible college, found out that those guys were just giving me their seminary notes from a couple years prior. So it didn't take me long to figure out, well, you go to the head of the stream. So after doing some research, I wound up at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School and did a Master of Arts in Religion, which I finished in the mid-80s. I started out in the MDiv program, the pastor's program, feeling kind of out of place because I wasn't there to become a pastor or a missionary. I was there to learn how to be a Christian in the world that I lived in. So my wife and I were there for a couple of years. We ran out of money. And so I dropped out of school, and after being out of school for about 8 years, I got down on my knees and paid a huge amount of continuation fees, and they let me back in so that I could change majors and finish with an MAR. So I graduated in the mid-80s from Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. I've always been interested in the intersection of Christianity and culture, primarily because of my reading of Francis Schaeffer. Francis Schaeffer was very instrumental in my thinking theologically, philosophically, thinking about the culture and so forth. I grew up in a small rural Methodist church in Middle Tennessee. If any of you know where Cookeville is, north of Cookeville, Pall Mall, Sergeant York country, that's where I grew up. And I grew up on a tobacco farm. And growing up on a small farm and going to a Methodist church, and then I read Francis Schaeffer, I've likened it to walking through a funnel, you know, from the small end, you walk through the funnel, and then all of a sudden you come to the big end and you look around and say, wow, there's a lot more out here than I ever knew about. So after teaching school for a while, I went to seminary and did my integrative paper on toward a theology of the modern corporation. And that was just very amateur type of thing, but it helped me move along. And I spent a number of years in corporate life. I became eventually the from the Mississippi River West, sales manager. I was offered the sales manager job for the whole country. I didn't want to travel that much. I wound up traveling that much anyway. So it was 3 weeks out on the road and then a week home living in Chicago. Then I spent the other week driving to Michigan and Minnesota and all of that. But during all of those years, thinking about what does it mean to be a Christian in a modern corporation, that was the question that drove me. And on the road, a lot of evenings I was stuck someplace, and so I carried my books and read. So a lot of what I have is just self-education, reading as broadly, especially in the area sociology of religion at that time. I was spending a lot of time there. And to shorten the story without giving you all the details, after a number of years in industrial sales, I had a chance to move back to Tennessee from living in Chicago. I grew up in Middle Tennessee, as I mentioned, and worked in industrial sales, selling equipment this time. Prior to that, I'd been in the packaging industry, and continuing to teach Sunday school classes. And the company I worked for was a distributor of German-made industrial equipment, and we were given a notice that we had about a year to make a decision on continuing our representation of those folks. And my boss said, well, no, we're not going to do that under those new terms. So my job was going to be eliminated. And I'd been teaching a Sunday school class on bioethics, and I thought, well, you know, I've had this interest in Christianity and culture for all these years, so why not do something in bioethics? And so I started looking around, and nobody was doing anything at the lay level. Now, Trinity Evangelical Divinity School has a Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity. That has been, at that time, Nigel Cameron was there and John Kilner. They're the two principals of putting that program together. And after looking around, I thought, well, you know, why not do something like this at the church? And I talked to my elders. They said, well, yeah, we'll stand behind you. So they took me on as an extension of the ministry of the church. And then after that period was up. And of course, I had a year to prepare for this. So I knew my job was winding down, so I did some preparation. And then we started out under the eldership of the church, and then they spun me off in September of 2004 as a 501c3, and as a nonprofit organization. So what I do is I speak to Sunday school classes, I speak in churches, I've led reading and discussion groups at Vanderbilt, working in conjunction with InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. Oh, it's actually InterVarsity's Graduate and Faculty Fellowship at Vanderbilt. I've led discussion groups at Middle Tennessee State. I've spoken to the Christian faculty group there. I've spoken to the Rotary Club. I've spoken to political parties. So doing grassroots type of bioethics education. And then 3 years ago, I started the Humanitas Forum on Christianity and Culture because I realized there were a lot of thinking people out there wanting to wrestle with and engage issues that were just not being touched on in their own church. So we have brought people like Peter Lawler, who is, up until just a few days ago, he was a member of the President's Council on Bioethics. He is actually, he spoke for us a year ago in October in Nashville. We brought Ken Meyer. Some of you will know Ken Myers from the Marsfield Audio Journal. Jeremy Beer from ISI. And just recently we had Ralph Wood, who's a theologian and literature professor from Baylor, who came and spoke for us on C.S. Lewis, two lectures on the Screwtape Letters and one on the Four Loves. So that is a bit of background for me. And if you got any questions, if you want to do something like this, I'll be happy to encourage you to do it, because it is a real need. And as we go through the evening, I hope you'll get a little bit of my passion for the intersection of Christianity and culture. I run into pastors, I run into medical doctors, and people who are aware of the issues, but they don't realize the magnitude of the challenge. So as we go through the evening, I hope you'll get a sense of what the scope of the challenge is, and how we, and together, as we have a couple discussion sessions, discuss how we as Christians can engage these issues. When Justin asked me to take these sessions, I put together an outline. So what I want to do is I'll just tell you what I'll try to do. We'll spend probably about 45-50 minutes on the first talk, and end up with a little time for questions. And then I have given some reading assignments. And do I dare ask for raise? And who has them? Who has read them? Oh, Justin. Oh, good. So I get to Justin, and I'll talk about these readings, and then you guys can listen in. But we'll spend the first hour, then we'll go and look at the four, maybe not all of them. We won't be able to get into a lot of detail on these talks, but we'll look at four of the readings. Then we'll take a brief break around 7:50, something like that, for 20 minutes or so, and then we'll come back for the second talk, and then a few more minutes to talk about the other readings. The first talk I've entitled Genes, Knives, Pills, and Electrodes. Genes, Knives, Pills, and Electrodes. Is Biotechnology a Remedy for the Human Condition? I've selected these four categories as a way of introducing some of the technologies as well as the ethical issues that go along with the technologies. So we'll use these as introductions. Once we've gone through that, then we'll come back to the what I'm calling the big question. Is biotechnology a remedy for the human condition? Genes, in that area, we're talking about genetics, and we'll focus on genetic screening as a particular issue. Now, each of these categories are broad, and I'm just picking one or two items to focus on. Knives, we'll talk about cosmetic surgery as well as a couple other issues. Pills, we'll talk about pharmacology, drugs, and we'll look specifically at the off-label use of certain drugs. And then the fourth category, electrodes, we'll talk a little bit about the brain-computer interface and brain chips. And then the big question, is biotechnology a remedy for the human condition? And of course, there are a range of answers to that. And as we go along, keep in mind definitions. How do we define remedy? How do we define the human condition? Those are the two critical things to keep in mind. Before we jump in and get started, there are a couple things that I want to say about the direction that we'll go. I'm certainly interested in specific issues and specific technologies, but I want to spend some time on those. But the thing I want to focus on is the cultural context for the development and the use of these various technologies. First of all, what is in the culture that drives the development of certain medical procedures and the development of certain medical technologies? Why do we do what we do? What guides our decisions individually and as a society? And what guides medicine? What guides research? You know, what is it that guides this? Is it just seeking for health? Or is it seeking for profit? Or are there other motives for the direction that we go? And then what drives all of this, as well as what are the social and cultural consequences of these technologies? How do they impact the society that we live in? And I want to be careful to let you know, even though I'm critical of certain of the biotechnologies and the way they're used, I want to make sure you understand that I'm very pro-technology as long as they're used in an ethical way. I had polio when I was a child. If the polio vaccine had been developed 10 years earlier, perhaps I wouldn't have had polio. So I understand the benefit of vaccines of all sorts, pacemakers, using animal heart valves in humans. My 90-year-old mom received a heart valve from a pig about 4 years ago. Her enjoyment of life, not only the enjoyment of it, but the extent of her life, was changed dramatically because of that biotech development. Organ transplants for kidneys, livers, and other tissue. Kidney dialysis, artificial joint replacement, vision correction with laser surgery. All of these are technologies that we can celebrate and be thankful for. And as I may sound critical at times, make sure that you keep that little caveat in the back, because I do appreciate these things. I would not want to live in a world without antibiotics. The first category, genes or genetics. As I said, we'll focus on genetic screening here and what's typically referred to as the production of designer babies. The technology here is PGD for short, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, PGD. This technology has been around for probably since the mid-90s, so it's been around 12 or 15 years. And the goal of this procedure is to make healthy babies, number one, number two, to make crippled babies, and number three, to produce babies of a desired sex. And the way the process works, embryos are created in vitro, created in the lab, and then at about 5 days, the embryo is 8 cells. One or two cells are pulled off, and they're screened for 200 to 300. I don't know exactly the number. You get different numbers from different people, but it's probably 200 to 300 different genetic diseases that they can be screened for. So if they want a healthy baby, then they discard the ones with genetic problems. If they want a disabled baby, then they discard the healthy embryos and keep the disabled ones. I see some frowns. You don't think that. We have a big survey that just came out a little over a year ago from Johns Hopkins. They did a survey of all the fertility clinics in the country, And they found that about 75% of the fertility clinics had this procedure, PGD, as a part of their product offering. And 3% of that 75% had actually used the procedure to make a disabled baby. And we're talking about here primarily babies that are deaf or babies with dwarfism. So, and this is legal, it's accepted medical practice, but what happens when you start using these technologies to develop disabled babies? You're changing the meaning of health, you're changing the meaning of medicine. You have a number of things going on there. We'll come back to this later. And then the other use for this product or this technology is to do sex selection. So a family that has three boys and they're dying to get a girl, they can create embryos in vitro and then select for the sex that they want. And 2 years ago, I read an article in Newsweek, there's a fertility clinic in Hollywood, that 25% of all of their customers, 25% of all of their clients were using PGD for sex selection. So what you have is creating the embryos, selecting in the ones you want, selecting out the ones you don't want. Now, this is eugenic. This is a eugenic procedure. Most people, when they hear the term eugenics, they think of Nazi Germany selecting against gypsies, Jews, just starting getting rid of those sort of people that were considered undesirable. But the term eugenics is being rehabilitated, not only in our culture, but around the world. The argument in the terminology is liberal eugenics. Liberal eugenics, and there's a book, in fact, by that title by Nicholas Agar, a philosopher from Australia. And his argument is basically this. As long as it's not coerced, as long as it's freely done by the parents, then it is not a bad sort of eugenics. Now, he still will call it eugenics, and you'll find other bioethics folks will not use the term eugenics because of the baggage that goes with it, but they will agree that the procedure is acceptable medical practice. It's ethical medical practice. So we have a rehabilitation of the term eugenics. For me, I prefer the term consumer eugenics. Basically, what parents are doing is creating embryos, they're creating human beings, and they're selecting the ones that they want and discarding the ones that they don't want. Picking and choosing the children based on their genetic makeup. Some people call this baby shopping. It's really a crude process of culling out the ones you don't want and keeping the ones that you do. And one of there are a number of medical issues with this. Of course, obviously, should we as parents be designing our children? You know, are our children products? Are they manufactured products? Or are they to be gifts from God? Of course, our worldview dictates how we see that, making and designing children. And then, of course, the cultural issues. What does this do to the meaning of parenting? It also changes the meaning of a family. To be in this family, you got to meet certain genetic QC standards, quality control standards. So it changes the meaning of parenting and family, and it also changes the purpose of medicine. So when we look at designer babies, the production of designer babies, to get to our big question, is it a remedy for the human condition? What is the human condition? The second category is knives. Here we'll look at cosmetic surgery. Actually, I've broadened this to be cosmetic procedures. Just a few statistics. We have almost 12 million cosmetic and surgical procedures in the United States in 2007. We don't have 2008 numbers yet. The people who monitor this, they're called the American Society for Aesthetic Plastic Surgery. So this is really the group that focuses on cosmetics, on aesthetics. These are not the folks that, some of them may as another part of the practice, but as this professional organization focuses on the cosmetic part, there are also folks who do reconstructive surgery for people in accidents and soldiers coming home and so forth. So almost 12 million procedures last year. The most frequently performed was Botox injections, getting rid of wrinkles around the eyes. Spent about $13 billion on cosmetic procedures in 2007. Since 1997, the number has increased. The number of procedures has increased 457%. One of the more popular procedures is called mommy makeovers. I don't know if you've heard about this, but these shows up. This is one of the more popular procedures. Breast enhancement and tummy tuck has become one of the more popular procedures, and this is women typically in their 40s who want to reclaim their pre-pregnancy bodies. So they want to look young again. And one surgeon has pointed out that when these folks talk about the tummy tuck or the breast enhancement, they're thinking in terms of regenerative or reconstructive surgery. They're not thinking, and they don't use the term cosmetic. So the terminology is quite indicative, I think, of the thinking. And these kind of things are the breast enhancement especially. A couple, 3 years ago, I led a reading discussion group at Vanderbilt. And one of the guys, we touched on this a little bit in one of the articles we were reading. And they go to a very well-known, a very prominent church in Nashville. And his wife came home from church one day horrified. And breast enhancements had been the big topic of discussion among the women preparing for their potluck. And his wife was horrified at the number of women who had done breast enhancements. So these are not just secular issues. What's going on when we are unhappy with aging? What's going on in our thinking when we're unwilling to live with the natural processes that nature gives us? So we're not only talking about mommy makeovers, facelifts, and all of those types of things. We're also talking about cosmetic surgery done on children. Parents give their teenage daughters breast implants for Christmas and birthdays. Parents of children with Down syndrome have surgery done to change the shape of their eyes and their ears. This is purely cosmetic. There's no real benefit to the, no medical benefit to the person involved. The media also reports something of a trend in reversal of cosmetic procedures. So the singer Courtney Love has had 3 nose jobs. She wasn't happy with the first one. She got a second one. She wasn't happy with that, so she got a third one. And she wasn't happy with that, so she wanted to go back to the nose that God gave her. That was her. That's her statement, you know. I just want the mouth. No, I'm sorry. It was a face job, and it was her mouth that she really wanted back. So she'd had 3 nose jobs and then also done some work, but she just wanted it back the way God gave it to her. So people are unhappy with themselves, so they change. How malleable are we, you know? Or is our body sort of like our hairdo or our clothes? Is it sort of a fashion type of thing? What is the body that God gave us? So the question is, are cosmetic procedures a remedy for the human condition? And by the way, as we're going along, I see some frowns and some nods. If you have any questions or comments, we'll stop and talk about them. Because what I'm doing is a quick overview, and there's a lot more that can be said on all of these things in terms of clarifying the issues and the technologies, okay? Yes, sir.
How slight does that become? There are several very successful dental practices to whitening, realigning,
smiles by design. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
probably for performers, people that are going to be out in the sales world. I don't know that for a fact, but that's where I guess the customers would come from.
I think they come from everywhere.
They do. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have a friend who had her teeth whitened. She's probably 75, and you know someone else who had veneers, you know. These are cosmetic procedures, and it's aesthetics, it's appearance. Yes, ma'am.
I have a comment from
Christine.
You're talking about how to protect their teenage daughters these surgeries, which is definitely true. I know Peter can probably have that, and a girl that I went to high school with, he was already really skinny, and I mean, he had like eating disorders forever, but it's getting more extreme, and she had liposuction when she was in high school, and she was already tiny, like really small. So it's crazy. My question, and sorry, this goes back a little bit to the genes part, if that's all right.
Yes, ma'am.
The last 2 weeks we talked about this, but if you could just answer another little question. With the embryos that are not used in vitro, the options, like how many they're just piling up, the frozen embryos, what are the options for what to do with that? I mean, I know we talked about adoption.
Adoption is.
If they do all of them, what does that look like?
Well, Well, sometimes I just throw them in the trash. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure they should take care of them in the same way that a hospital would dispose of human tissue. So technically, there are procedures. But the articles that you read and the people you talk to, they are probably just flushed down the toilet.
How common is it? Is that like almost all of them that happens
to you? No, it doesn't happen to all of them. There's a RAND study that's about 2 years old that found that there's probably 400,000 or better in storage. From what I've read, that may be a bit of a conservative number. So we've got that many, and people say that they're very ambiguous about, you know, this is just tissue in one sense, so they can freeze it. But on the other hand, they really are ambivalent about destroying them. And part of it is they may want to use them later. They just don't know what to do with them. And so they're just lingering there. And the oldest embryo that I've heard about being thawed and implanted is 13 years. So that child, when it was born, had a sibling, a twin, I guess you would say, that was already a teenager. And part of the thing with freezing embryos, part of the thing is with embryos, we don't know what freezing does. I have a family very close to me, it's the grandfather, there's a very good, very close friend of mine. He and his wife on some restaurants, and they funded the fertility treatment for their son and daughter-in-law. And they were far enough in that they had four children under 6 years old, and they still had 12 frozen embryos. And it was only at that point that they realized that these are human beings that we have a moral obligation to. These are our children. And so they are now trying to adopt out the remaining embryos. Now, they've had one more procedure since then, so they're down to 9 embryos now. They're trying to adopt them out, but part of the problem they're running into is one of the children has autism. That's diagnosed. It's been in special school for maybe, well, at least 2 years. And then there's another younger child, I think number 3, that has some of the same tendencies as he's developing. So he may be autistic as well, which means that people who are going to adopt may not want to adopt with the potential for autism. So that family becomes sort of a second tier possibility. So,
do you know what happens to the embryos when they're frozen for a really long time?
What?
Being an adult, they don't know what happens to the embryos when they're frozen for years and years and years, but do you know?
Well, we don't know really what happens to them just freezing, period. And then the obvious first question, and one of my, the first chairman of my board, Michael Bishop, is a doctor in Nashville. He's worked in fertility for years. And he says that, you know, well, obviously, should we be freezing humans? Is that proper treatment for human beings? Do I love my neighbor by freezing my neighbor and keeping him in suspension for 13 years or 18 or 20 years with the risk that the freezing will damage the genetics that are there? And then we know the risk of thawing. There's a fairly high risk rate to the thawing. So, sir.
Going back to cosmetic procedures, when you're talking about the number, just in general, when people talk about procedures, just as simple as braces, like, does that do those?
Simple procedures as
well. Braces, just basic orthodontics?
No, that is not counted. No.
Is that just classified as something different?
I'm not sure how that would be counted, but the association, whatever they were called, the aesthetics group, they would not include that. They're really the people who do like the Botox, the surgery, but not the dental. So if you put dental into that, then you would really increase the numbers.
Would you consider it as same or similar as some of the
other? Yeah, my wife and I wrestled with that once. Our oldest son got an injury from actually falling out of a tree. And during the process, the dentist recommended we have his teeth straightened. And they weren't that bad. And I remembered my teeth. I had some problems, and they straightened up. And so we went through the process of agonizing and getting prices and everything. And I actually went back and had a one-on-one with him, and I said, you know, do we need this? Do we really need this? And he said, well, it's really cosmetic. So after 2 or 3 days of turmoil and a couple phone calls back and forth, my wife and I agonizing, you know, you want to do the best for your child. And then when he finally hit the bottom line and said, this is cosmetic, then we said, well, you know, we're not going to do it. And that was it's about almost 20 years ago. It was $2,500, and that was just a small segment of his mouth. So some of these things, I think, are cosmetic, and I think a number of things that happen in our culture that become medical procedures, they kind of get to be the thing to do in the culture. And so it's just a rite of passage that you get braces, you know. And part of it is our attitude toward perfection, you know. We want not just, you know, to eat properly, but we want to look well also. Yes.
Well, this may be jumping ahead, but at what point do the lawyers get involved in this, talking about disposition of wills and things like that, and who's related to who, and how do you name somebody that's been frozen for 13 years? You know, are they cold aunts or cold uncles or what?
Baby's on ice, I guess. We won't have time to dig into this, but the legal ramifications of this are really, really serious. Who owns those embryos? And what are the embryos? Are they human beings? The courts don't think they're human beings. The courts don't think they're property either. They developed a third category, and it's quasi-property. And they actually, one of the major cases was decided by the Supreme Court here in the state of Tennessee. I can't remember if it was, is it Cook by Cook versus Cook or something like that? This couple got divorced, they had these embryos, and then they had the big battle over whose embryos were they. And you find this all the time. Women will get possession of the embryos, they'll have them implanted, they'll have a baby, and then is the husband then obligated? They are divorced. Is he then obligated to pay child support? See, the thing about bioethics is that it is not just the clinical situation of deciding, can we make a baby and going through the technical processes? Because it has social, cultural ramifications, it has legal ramifications. So the tentacles of this runs into all areas of society. Let's move on and look at the two other categories. The third one is pills. Here we'll focus on the off-label use of certain medications. I'm just going to pick up on an article from the New York Times. It's probably about 3 years old. The lady who wrote the article decided to do an article on this particular subject, so she interviewed students at different universities. The lady that she tells about in the article is a lady by the name of Angela. She's a student at Columbia University, and when the reporter caught up with her, she had been up two nights. She was on her third all-nighter, getting through finals. So she had finished off her French exam, she finished off her music exam, and I forget, she'd written a paper on Finnegan's Wake. So she'd been up two nights, she was 11 o'clock on the third night, and she had one more exam, her Latin American literature class exam the next day. And she was outside the library smoking when the reporter started talking with her. And she says, this is just killing me. This week is killing me, and I really need some help. So what she was doing at that point was looking for the help, and she found it. One of her friends was willing to sell her an Adderall pill, 30 milligram of Adderall. And she washed that down with coffee, quite appropriately, I guess. And then she went back to the library. Later, the journalist followed up with her, and she had aced her exam. And this is the quote she got on the follow-up. Angela said, I don't think I could keep my 3.9 average without this stuff. I couldn't keep my 3.9 without this, with the Adderall, without these other things to keep me going. In the article, it says that many colleges across the country, the ingredients for academic success now include a steady flow of analeptics, that's the class of prescription amphetamines that is used to treat attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So what we're running into with Prozac and a number of these pills, Adderall, is the off-label use of them. They're used in many cases very well for treating people who really need them, who really do need them for the ADHD problem, to help them concentrate, to stay focused. Interestingly, a recent article, and I was talking to Justin about this over dinner, there's an article in the Journal of Medical Ethics as well as in Nature And these are well-known scientists saying that students should be allowed to use drugs such as Ritalin, that was the one they mentioned, Ritalin, without prescription to boost their mental sharpness and memory. So we have this in the scientific community. Well, if any of you, probably none of you, who reads the Chronicle of Higher Education? In the last year, there's been a long running. I didn't mean to embarrass you. But there's been a debate off and on about professors and researchers using the drugs for the same reason. It's a very competitive world in research and academics. So these guys, many of them in the hard sciences, they know the chemistry or whatever, and so they use these things as well. So it's kind of natural that the researchers and the academics come out and say, well, the students should be using these as well. So where does this go? Is the use of pharmaceuticals in this way a remedy for the human condition? And then, yes, ma'am. Do we have a confession here?
No.
Sorry about that.
No. I did fail a drug test recently.
I'm sorry?
It was CLEP.
Oh, okay.
I wasn't sure how much I knew about drugs. I just have a question, you know, being an older student, I see things differently, I think, than younger students. They have a lot more to go on than I do to get through today. But I have a question, you know, are we pushing people too much in college that there are, I mean, this isn't a new thing. This has been going on for people taking drugs to get to school.
It's not new.
I mean, a lot of people aren't, you know, don't get hooked on drugs because they want to party at college. A lot of them get hooked on drugs because they're trying to make it through college because there is a heavy workload. There is a lot of pressure that can be overwhelming.
And my impression in reading this article, and there's more to it with Angela at Columbia, I mean, this girl really has a workload. So, you know, I can see she's really pushed.
Mm-hmm. You know, so I have passion for things happen. Shouldn't we change the way we do things?
Oh. I would certainly think so, yeah. Yes, sir.
How has it been viewed about anabolic steroids or other performance-enhancing products for athletes?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if you say that we won't allow those types of things for athletes, professional or amateur, and you're not allowed to compete, especially in sports, yet we say it's okay that you can have academic enhancement with stimulants.
Yeah. But you have a whole group of people who say, yes, we should use steroids in athletics. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in both arenas, you have people saying, what is excellence? What is human accomplishment? At what point do we get to a competition between the chemist? You know, is it really the student in the classroom or the professor or the researcher? You know, who's really competing here? The guy who has the best chemistry, this is where the competition is. These guys only have to look around, you know, Barry Bonds, you know, did he pick the best chemist, you know? So those are the kind of questions we get to. Back to this lady. Yes, ma'am.
For pushing ourselves academically and sports-wise or whatever, the competition we drive in us is pushing us beyond our human capabilities to where we have to use drugs. I mean, there's just something really disturbing about that we can't just compete on a human level, that it has to be superhuman.
Now that's one of the questions I'll come to also in the second talk. You know, we have in competition our desires, our dreams, and then we have our natural human limits. And with the technologies that we've got now, we can push those limits. You know, and what are we doing to our definition of being human? You know, what does it mean to be a human?
That competition is there for slots in grad school or medical school or jobs. And as soon as one person in the race takes advantage of enhancements, then it creates real problems.
Yeah.
With anabolic steroids, of course, there's some health issues there. That, you know,
and almost all of these things have side effects.
Well, that's what I was asking. Is this as much with the ADHD medications?
Yeah, there's side effects there, but people say, well, you know, it's worth the trade-off. You know, they make that. you know, like some of the athletes. I've read about athletes who said that if they took steroids and they could win a gold medal, but yet know that they would die in 5 years, they would take it and they would win the gold medal. That's the attitude.
Yeah. We know that athlete with steroids. Is it that severe with these other
athletes? I don't have any first-person reports of that, but I would expect that it is. Because, you know, in graduate school, you and I read this stuff all the time, you know, this student says, well, if I don't do that, pull those three all-nighters, then I'm going to fall behind and then I'll have trouble getting into, you know, whatever, you know, getting a job or postdoc or whatever. Yeah, it can be very severe. Now, that isn't true across the board. I have a son who's finishing a PhD in physics at the University of Illinois, and he has not run into this. He's run into it in a few times, but not a lot, because he has a real special area, so he's not really competing with anyone except himself. But you hear graduate students, you know, some of the folks in the English and the humanities, those are the people who really know that they've got to be at the top in order to get the job that comes out there. Yes, sir.
Is there another step? I think the most recent thing is masking chemicals that, you know, destroy the evidence that the banned chemical was there. Is down the road, are there other things like this, other levels?
Yeah, I don't want to get into it. We do need to move on, but there is gene therapy, and we're already starting to see some of those things, and probably the next Olympics, the 2012. Gene therapy used for enhancement will be very much impossible. I mean, very difficult, or at least it looks like at this point. So the people in the anti-doping agencies are really in a race with the guys who want to create the bootleg treatments in order to say, can we detect how people are cheating? Can we keep a level playing field? Let's move on. One more thing before we look to the big question. I'm going to have to keep moving if I kind of even stay close to being on time. Electrodes, the fourth category, the brain-computer interface. The brain-computer interface comes in two forms. One, the hardwired interface, and then the wearable interface. The hardwired interface can be wired into the nervous system, or it can be wired into the brain. So we have a gentleman in Dayton, Tennessee, by the name of Jesse Sullivan. I don't know, are any familiar with Jesse Sullivan? The name ring a bell, Justin? No? Jesse Sullivan lost both arms, he worked for the power company, and lost both arms in an accident, and worked with a big research group in Chicago. They were actually at a point of developing prostheses for people like him when his accident occurred, and they contacted him and found out that he was really a perfect candidate for what they wanted to do. So they put on the right arm, which is the prosthesis that we're familiar with. You move it by moving your shoulder and your different muscles. The one on the left side is hardwired into his nervous system. So just by thinking, he can move his arm, just by thinking. It took a while to learn to do that. I have a picture of him painting his house, hugging his grandchildren. In fact, when he got through the first installation, the first procedure at the Institute up in Chicago, they said, go home and use this thing as close to normal as possible, because we want to check it out. We want to see how good our engineering is. So they sent him home. He decided to mow the yard. So when he starts the lawnmower, he pulls the hand off. So here he is with his hand. He has to go back to Chicago to get his hand put back on.
I thought you were going to say you
He is literally a bionic man. You got that right. But he pulled his hand off. He went back, and I think they may have already done the right side. But the idea was that the left one would be wired in. They'd do some perfecting of that. Then they would do the right arm. There was a woman who was injured in the military. She's in this same. Now these are clinical trials. This is not off-the-shelf stuff, okay? So there's a woman that's going into this, and I understood several months ago two more people would be into the trials. The FDA is watching all of this. There's a guy out in Baltimore, I believe it was, who is in a wheelchair, and he was in a knife fight, got stabbed in the neck, and lost the use of his arms and legs. And the pictures I have of him, and the video as well, is a, I don't think it's a YouTube clip, I think it was the research facility had it on their website. He has a box on top of his head, and there's a wire runs off to a computer. And just by thinking, he can operate his email, operate the computer. And the last time I heard, he was getting to the point where he was starting to use a robotic arm just by thinking. So you can see some of these things are going to be fabulous for the person with as a paraplegic. You know, they can get themselves a drink, they can do these kind of things. So we have some really interesting and some really good things coming down the road. So it can be wired into the nervous system. And then, by the way, the guy that has the box on his head, he has an implant in his brain as a strategic point. And the brain signals are picked up. They go to the computer and he operates. And of course, eventually that would be wireless. But the problem with those kind of implants is conductivity. And so after a while, they fail to get good signals back and forth. So there are some problems with these things. But I think we're working on that. Justin just sent me an article that touches on some of the things that are being done to remedy the problems with the implant. The other is the wearable interface. Let me give you a little bit of information on that. The U.S. Army has just awarded a multi-million-dollar contract to three large universities to develop a thought helmet. The idea here is that you would pick up deep brain signals, you would decode them, and then just by thinking, one soldier could send a command to another soldier, or a number of soldiers. Now you've got problems here, because the skull cap does not pick up the signals as well as the direct implant. But the government is working on this. And so are the gamers, the guys who make the games, you know. And this has been in research for several years, and for 3 years I've been reading about this and see some of the experimental pictures. This guy's sitting there with a skull cap, and he's got 17 up to 32 wires coming out of the cap. So what they're doing is they're picking up brain waves. And this thing is far enough along that a company in San Francisco will be introducing a version of this for $300 for the gamers this summer. Mm. So the gamers are ahead of the military, probably. But in case you're interested in buying one of these, Emotive Systems, you can jot that down. EMOTIV, Emotive Systems, you can jot that down, and this summer you can buy your own skull cap too. That way you can sit and eat and drink and just think the video game. You don't have to stop gaming in order to eat. And then there are other interesting developments here. Just a few weeks ago, I knew this was coming, and you would have guessed it as well. There is a bionic sex chip. Scientists are working on an electronic sex chip that will be able to stimulate pleasure centers in the brain. Now you laugh about that. It's coming. Yeah. In fact, this technology has already been used in clinical trials to treat Parkinson's patients. So the technology is there. It's a matter of redirecting where it is. Yes, ma'am.
What's to keep it from sending regular thoughts that you might just have at random instead of this direct thought? Because you could really get yourself in trouble.
Well, you really could. And that's part of the ethical dilemma that the military has in requiring their guys. They're going to have to be trained to be able to do certain things with that. So, you know, in the military, people who don't like their officers. A friend of mine was a lieutenant colonel in Vietnam, and he had several attempts on his life. So you're crawling through the bushes, and you say, oh man, I hope they get this guy this time. And then he knows what you're thinking. So you got a number of ethical dilemmas there. Could that happen? I don't know. So we're in the early stages of developing this. But like Leon Cass was the first chairman of the President's Council on Bioethics under the Bush administration. He says, I'm not counting against any of these things. He says, where they go, you can't predict. You just know that they're there, and at some point they're going to come along. So, you know, that's a very interesting question. That's obviously the question that comes up. But out of all of this, for brain chemistry, the implants, all of this are a huge, huge number of ethical issues. In fact, is such a big area that within the last 10 years, there's a whole new arena, a whole new discipline within bioethics. It's called neuroethics, just to study and to work with this particular area. Now, if I were some of you guys, if I were 23 instead of 83, I would go into neuroethics. And what I would do was not only do the science part, but I'd also want a good degree in theology, anthropology specifically, to wed those. Christians are not working in these areas. You know, at the intersection of bioethics, you have lots of ethical and legal issues that Christians are not. We're just not engaged in this. So bottom line, part of my mission here is to encourage some of you who are students to think about some of these disciplines as careers. The challenge is huge, and we are way, way behind the game. One quick question before we move on to our big question. Yes, ma'am.
I was just asking that, you know, what when you get someone else's thought, like, what is that like? Like, you don't hear a voice, do you think that thought too?
Like, I don't know.
Keep in mind,
I'm a generalist. I know these things in generalities. I don't know all the particulars.
Like, that said, he's cute, and so I think he's cute. Yeah. I don't understand what that would be like. Yeah.
There's a guy at Oxford or Cambridge who has done some implants with him and his wife, and he's working on some of these things. And the idea is that when he drinks a glass of wine and gets the feeling mellow, his wife will feel mellow whether she drinks wine or not. He's cheap. He'd rather give her a tip. No. I'm sorry, I didn't get it.
The comment was made back here. It's a cheaper way.
Yeah, it's a chipper way. It's a chipper way. There's some other things along this line that... robotics and artificial intelligence, some interesting things that are happening there. That does not involve electrodes in the human brain. And sex bots, I'll just leave that one to your imagination. Is biotechnology a remedy for the human condition? And of course, the answer to that question has to do with what your definitions are. What is the human condition and what would be the remedies for it? I'm going to skip over one section here where I was going to do a little bit of sort of an inclusion of something that really didn't fit. I'm going to skip over that and pick up one ethical system that is prominent in our culture to look at, to answer. I mean, within bioethics, you have a whole range. I mean, many of us who are not in secular bioethics, we just think of it as one big blob. You know, it's just there, it's uniform, it's pretty much the same. All the way across. Well, that isn't in fact the case at all. There are lots of variation within bioethics. What I've decided to do is pick up on the ethical system of Peter Singer, his preference utilitarianism, to talk about that ethical system among the many that we could talk about. Now, we could talk about transhumanism. These are the folks, are any familiar with transhumanism, the transhumanists? These people feel that we're transitional beings, transitional on the way to post-human creatures. So we could talk about a number of people, but let's talk about Peter Singer primarily because of his influence in the culture, and also his preference utilitarianism reflects the culture in many ways. In fact, that's probably why it's so easily and so widely adopted, is that it just kind of fits what's already here. Peter Singer is a professor of bioethics at Princeton, where he holds an endowed chair, one of the most prestigious chairs in the country. He's an Australian that came to the States in the late 90s, 1998, 1999, something like that. He already had an international reputation as a philosopher when he came to Princeton. I guess on second thought, that's how you get these kind of jobs, is having a reputation like that. He has been described as the most influential living philosopher in the world. Sorry, Justin, that position's already taken. And just one gauge of that, he has a new book coming out in March. The Life You Can Save is the title, and it's on poverty. It's coming out from Random House in March with publication simultaneously in the United States, England, Australia, and Sweden. And it's already in preparation and for publication in five other languages. So that gives you an idea of the weight this guy pulls. I want to look at three aspects of Singer's ethical system. And as we go along, keeping in mind, what is the human condition and what's the remedy for it? A brief overview of preference utilitarianism. The preference utilitarians, for them, the greatest good is achieved when the greatest number of preferences are satisfied. Utilitarianism holds that actions are to be judged by their usefulness or their utility. The moral worth of an action is judged by its outcome. Or simply put, the ends justifies the means. We ought to maximize the good and minimize the bad, but how do we define what's good and what's bad? That becomes the question. So some thinkers would argue that the good that we should be seeking is happiness, pleasure, as against pain and suffering. But for the preference utilitarianism, the utilitarians, the greatest good is achieved when the greatest number of preferences are satisfied. For the preference utilitarians, the greatest good is achieved when the greatest number of preferences are satisfied. So good, then, is getting what we want, and bad is the opposite, not getting what we want. Singer's preference utilitarianism is closely connected to his view of personhood. Are many of you familiar with Peter Singer? I know many of you have heard of him. And those who read the article that was assigned, you got a good introduction to Peter Singer. For Peter Singer, the characteristics of being a person are rationality, autonomy, and self-consciousness. Now, at different places, he gives different lists, but those are usually the three core ones that show up. So if you are rational, autonomous, and self-conscious, he would consider you to be a person. Without these characteristics, a being is not a person, even though they may be human. It is possible, according to Singer, then, obviously, to be human, but not a person. A fetus or a newborn baby is not a person because they lack rationality, autonomy, and self-consciousness. He says the fact that a being is a human being, in the sense of a member of the species Homo sapiens, is not relevant to the wrongness of killing it. It is, rather, the characteristics like rationality, autonomy, and self-consciousness that makes the difference. So according to Peter Singer, then, a newborn baby could be killed without doing wrong to the baby. Now, if there were parents or somebody that wanted to adopt the child, their preference to adopt that child would be wrong, but it would not be morally wrong against the killing of the newborn infant because it is not yet a person. And of course, people with Alzheimer's, cognitively disabled persons, humans, he would call them humans, not persons. Interestingly, Peter Singer's mother died with Alzheimer's, and that was a thing that came up a number of times in debates that he had. What about your mother? What about the money you're spending on your mom? And without trying to give you a bit of the background, the bottom line was in one debate, he got cornered on this and somehow said, well, it's different when it's your mom. It's different when it's your mom. So someplace in his heart, he found the ability to say there are some distinctions. And usually in debates, when that was brought up, he would put it off as well. It was his family. The family pressures caused him to spend the money on keeping up his mother with Alzheimer's rather than giving it to some poor person who needed food or medical care. So with Singer, it's possible to be human but not a person. But on the other hand, it's possible to be a person and not a human. Using these characteristics, he extends personhood and moral standing of persons to the higher mammals. The great apes, according to Singer, would be persons. They should have the moral standing of persons. And, of course, he is a founder of the Great Ape Project. He is sort of the guru of the animal rights movement. Chimpanzees, gorillas, and orangutans, these animals are self-conscious. They want to go on living, he says. They have rationality. They're autonomous. And so it would be wrong to kill them. I assume that he doesn't feel competition from a gorilla to get his position at Princeton, but could a gorilla have that sort of preference? And what he's really after is the preferences that they are capable of having to go on living, to be safe, to be fed, those kind of things. He's a leading animal rights activist. Helps run the Great Apes Project. And by the way, in Spain, the Environmental Committee has recommended to the Parliament, and looks like, and I may not have heard, the Parliament may have approved, the personhood of the Great Apes in Spain. So this is coming. It's going to be coming down the pike in different countries around the world. So it looks, the last I heard, it looked like the thing would pass through the Spanish Parliament, that apes, the Great Apes, would be given personhood status in Spain. Okay, that's where things start getting a bit complicated, because to say an ape has personhood, okay, what preferences is an ape, a gorilla or a chimpanzee, what preferences are they capable of having? So, you know, and I was being a bit smart, I was talking about taking Singer's position at Princeton. So they could have the preference for food, possibly medical care. This is an issue that comes up. Will we need to think about doing kidney transplants on apes? You know, if they have a preference to go on living, to have a certain level of health, will we then be obligated to provide kidney transplants for apes? So this all has to be sorted out. And really what happens with the animal... I'm sorry?
Then
how would you get consent? You know, see, that's part of our donor system, getting consent. So, but as this works along, there will be a number of sticky things that come up. If it is really pursued. And at some point, I think you may find a backlash against this. But what it really does, without digging into the nitty-gritty, is it shows a loss of distinction between humans and animals. That's really a part of the bottom line. So with the death of humanism, with Enlightenment humanism losing its place with a postmodern view of the self-constructed individual, we have a loss of humanism, and then all of a sudden we have a blurring or a disappearance of lines between the species. In fact, that's another one of the things for Singer that I wanted to mention, is speciesism. This is a term that he coined. He says speciesism is a prejudice or an attitude of bias in favor of the interest of members of one's own species against the members of another species. And he goes on and he argues that human-centered morality, or speciesism, is a human-centered morality that is as abhorrent as racism or sexism. All beings with interest are entitled to equal consideration. That is, we should give their interest, we should not give their interest any less consideration than we give to the similar interest of members of our own species. He wrote the book Animal Liberation. I don't know if any of you have come across this. If you take philosophy courses, some of the writings from Singer are used, and often excerpts from Animal Liberation, or even the book itself. Singer is, of course, not only a co-founder of the Great Ape Project, he's a vegetarian. Some of you will know the name Nigel Cameron. Nigel Cameron has debated Peter Singer on a number of occasions. He says it's quite interesting. When you invite Peter Singer to a debate, the list of things you do and you don't do, and one of them is spelled out very clearly, is where you go to eat, the kind of diet that he has. So that becomes a headache. If you ever want to invite him here to Union, you better figure out the diet thing first. Anyway,
no barbecue?
Probably no barbecue. Probably no barbecue. So the three things that I hope I kind of touched on for Peter Singer is his preference utilitarianism, his personhood theory, and then the place where he stands on animal rights. Let's wrap up. We're running quite a bit over here. Let's wrap up. With the type of thinking that we see in Peter Singer, we see a clear expression. The advantage of Peter Singer is that he gets to the point. He doesn't try to hide things. He comes right out. He lays it on the table. And so you see him working out the logic of his assumptions. And it's clear with Singer, as well as other people in the culture, we have a loss of human exceptionalism. and you'll find that at different places. There's a crisis of humanism. This is a worldview of Singer's that's very much at odds with a Christian worldview. And in bioethics, especially in Singer, you can see the connection, worldview, ethical system, and then the implications. See this very, very, very clearly. And of course, you can't, I don't think, deal with bioethical issues in a clinical way. Yes, you can, but you're not getting the whole picture unless you deal with the larger framework. Singer's views are a part of a cultural revolution that drives, I think, the biotech revolution, and then the technologies in turn enable the realization of the goals of the cultural revolution. Let's just call it quits for this talk and talk a bit about some of the things, some of the other questions that you have. And then I'd like to take a few minutes to look at some of the articles that you were assigned. And then we'll take a break in about 45 or 50 minutes. Justin.
Could I add a couple of comments?
Sure.
And you may want to hit stop on this. But let's see if